Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. This week, we are on location at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's annual convention in Kansas City. It's part of our effort at AgriPulse to get out of the D.C. Beltway on occasion and meet with some of the folks from rural America working and doing the production agriculture industry that we cover from a policy perspective in Washington. We had the opportunity to speak to many folks at this year's convention and trade talk, including USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney. Our first interview on the show this week is with Undersecretary Bonney, and he discusses the Emergency Relief Program Phase 2 announcement from USDA this week, as well as the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities and many other farm production and conservation issues. Let's take a look.
Yeah, so obviously the first run on ERP and ELRP Phase 1 was really about how do we use our existing crop insurance, get data that we have, existing data, and use that to get those resources out to the producers that have been impacted in 20 and 21. We always knew going in that there were going to be some folks that might fall through the cracks. The job with phase two of ERP and ELRP is to get those folks that have fallen through the cracks. And we use a revenue-based approach. And so what we wanted to do was wrap up phase one so we can finish that. People get their data in by middle of December. And then we want to start the process. And there'll be more information to come for producers on actually exactly how it will work so that we can begin phase two and start that process.
Are other phases coming, or is phase two going to be
the extent? Phase two is it.
Okay, very good. Also want to talk about the Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities that the department has rolled out this year. We've seen the kind of the bigger program announcements, yep, but still awaiting some of these smaller program announcements. When can we expect to see that?
Yeah, so we had two groups of funding, obviously $2.8 billion for 70 projects already rolled out. We're going to roll another about $325 million for about 65, maybe a little bit more projects. We expect to see that in the coming weeks. It's not long away. Those projects are focused more at either innovative practices or historically underserved producers. We got a lot of interest in it. We got over 400 proposals, or I should say we got over 600 proposals there. And so lots of interest in it, and we've got some really good projects, and we'll move here pretty soon.
This was originally a $1 billion program. It's since grown beyond that. But $19 billion in applications, the desire is clearly there. Is this strictly a 2022 program, or is Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities something we might see more of in the future?
Right now, we're just focused on execution. We're working now to begin the process of getting the contracts with the first round of proposals. We'll do the same with the second group of projects. We haven't thought about a second tranche of funding. We want to get this right. And so you'll see us spending a lot of time on execution, trying to get resources out, doing it in a way that will both help those projects get going, but also we need to do some learning from those projects. So haven't thought about whether we want to do this again, really focused on execution.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you look to the future of this program, we're already seeing some comments from folks on Capitol Hill wondering whether or not this is an appropriate use of the Commodity Credit Corporation, wondering whether or not this is something that's appropriate when a farm bill is due to be reauthorized pretty soon. How do you generate support for this kind of program, this kind of spending from the Republican side of the aisle?
I think the most important thing in designing this, we try to do a lot of listening. We've tried to design something that works for agriculture and forestry that has their fingerprints all over it. We had the kernel of an idea when we came into the administration, but it's agriculture and forestry that have helped shape it. And I think that's most important. And our theory all along is if we do that and we listen and we build something that works for agriculture, that the politics will take care of themselves. There'll be questions about the Commodity Credit Corporation. This is a really good use of the Commodity Credit Corporation. It derives its sort of authorities directly from the statute. We're very confident there. And we think it's a good approach because it's flexible dollars, it's producer-led, it's voluntary, it's incentive-based. It's designed to create markets that will help fund these types of practices. And so hopefully over time, maybe there's less need for government resources for this type of an approach. But we think infusing the dollars early, getting folks going, creating some innovative efforts out in the countryside is the right approach here. And again, what we've tried to do is build this in a way that works for agriculture and forestry. Politics will take care of themselves.
We'll be right back with more from USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney right after this.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. The Emergency Relief Program and the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities are just a few of the things on Undersecretary Robert Bonney's list at the Department of Agriculture. We also discussed a number of other things, as you'll see in the second half of our interview. Also on the political front, the Inflation Reduction Act obviously contained a good deal of funding for conservation programs. And I suppose whether or not you think that applies to farm bill programs depends on which side of the aisle you're sitting on right now. Where does the department stand on that subject?
Well, we got some great resources in the Inflation Reduction Act. Obviously, NRCS got a significant amount of resources for its existing farm programs to be able to focus resources on climate smart practices. Our job right now is to roll those dollars out, to get them out to the countryside. We're opening up a short public comment period today to start to take some input. Everything we do on climate, we wanna do a lot of listening, but at the same time, we're also trying to move resources quickly. So wintertime, we'll start putting resources out to the states, get them out in the field. And so we'll spend a lot of time on execution and making sure we're building the partnerships out in the countryside to deploy those resources. It'll obviously be a conversation in the 23 Farm Bill, but we're really focused again on execution, getting the resources out and doing it in a way that actually works for folks on the ground.
Mm-hmm. All of the things that you talk about, whether it's climate smart commodities, whether it's ERP, some of the other efforts that are under kind of the FPAC umbrella, will require people on the ground. Do you have the workforce necessary to make these programs work, or do you need more people?
It's a really important question. The truth is we need more people, and we're working quickly to hire more people. One of the challenges we face is the tight market we have right now. We need to look at things. Are we paying our folks enough? Are we providing the type of benefits and flexibilities we need out in the countryside to hold on to our workforce? Critically important question across the administration, but Secretary Vilsack and all of us are thinking about it a lot. Even if we hire everyone that we want, we still need to build the partnerships with universities, with commodity groups, with conservation districts, with everybody on the ground to be able to deploy these types of approaches, whether it's on the climate side, the risk management side. And so we recognize that we've really got to build a broad infrastructure even outside of USDA.
Mm-hmm. What's the bigger constraint? Is it perhaps a dearth of qualified applicants? Is it a lack of funding on the way of the departments to pay the folks that are qualified? What's the bigger struggle?
Well, I think, part of it is looking at the way we pay people and compensate people across USDA and the federal government. So that's a piece of it. Part of it is we all see a very competitive job market right now. And that's creating challenges for folks in agriculture as well as folks in USDA. And we've got to continue to figure out ways to bring new people into USDA. So there's a lot of conversation about making sure we do that. And again, even if we bring in everybody that we want, we're never gonna have enough people. We've got to figure out how we streamline programs, how we make it easier for our producers as well as our staff, and how we build partnerships to do that.
Wrapping up our conversation here, the department's taken a lot of efforts to encourage the use of double cropping here in the United States. What have you seen by way of reception of those efforts?
Yeah, quite a lot of interest. I mean, our effort has really been how to, particularly on the RMA side, crop insurance side, how do we streamline procedures? How do we make it easier for folks to do double cropping? We've seen in the wake of Ukraine that we need to have the ability to produce more on the same acreage. Productivity is obviously critically important. We've just passed 8 billion people in the news and on planet Earth, more to come. And even as we think about things like climate change, productivity in and of itself is really important. Double cropping is gonna play a really important role. And so we're always looking at ways, how do we tweak our programs? How do we listen to agriculture and make things easier for producers? And that's what the double cropping piece is about.
Mr. Undersecretary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
We'll be right back to hear from EPA Agricultural Advisor Rod Snyder right after this.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices.
and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. The Environmental Protection Agency was recently given until the end of November to finalize its proposal for renewable volume obligations under the Renewable Fuel Standard. EPA Agricultural Advisor Rod Snyder says that's a timeline the agency plans to meet.
Yes, we're planning to stick with that November 30th deadline. The package went to the White House, to OMB, I believe last week. So it seems to be on track, and our intention is to meet the November 30th deadline.
Mm-hmm. So what can we expect? I know you're probably not going to be looking to give us exact figures and move markets that way, but this is a really complex discussion, as you well know, between the interests of the biofuels community, the interests of the oil and energy sector. How do you thread that needle with this upcoming rollout? Also understanding this could be a multi-year rollout, as has been discussed.
Well, let me just start by saying, for Administrator Regan and for the Biden administration, getting the RFS program back on track and on a stable footing, I think, was a key priority when we arrived last year. And so let's take a retrospective look for just a second to start out with. If you look at the 2022 volumes, they were the highest ever proposed by the agency. The administrator has talked about the role of biofuels for the rural economy as a solution to climate change, low carbon homegrown biofuels. So the commitment to growing the program has clearly been demonstrated, I think, with our past regulatory actions. You also saw that the decisions on the small refinery exemptions, I think, also helped to stabilize the program in terms of those volumes as well. Going forward, there's been a lot of interest, I think, from all sides in a multi-year solution. I can't talk really about, of course, what's pending at OMB. But our goal is to continue to strengthen the RFS and also just provide predictability and stability to the industry going forward.
Mm-hmm. A couple more trains of thought on the biofuel subject. Of course, there has been 9 governors from the Midwest submit a petition to request regulatory relief and allow them to sell E15 during the summer months. What is the status of that petition at EPA?
We're continuing to work on the rule that goes along with that RVP waiver. We've been in communication with the governor's offices over the course of a number of months, and we are still anticipating proposing that rule in the near future. I don't have an exact timeline on that yet, but I think the administrator has spoken pretty publicly about this issue, including at the Growth Energy Summit this fall, that we're committed to working with the states on this solution as a way to ensure year-round sales. And of course, it builds on President Biden's announcement earlier this year for the 2022 summer, the emergency waiver because of the situation in Ukraine and what was going on with fuel supply. We took a pretty bold step for summer of 2022 to ensure that E15 remained available through this year. That was the mechanism that I think was appropriate for 2022. What the governors are working on for a more permanent solution is something that we're eager to collaborate with them on.
Mm-hmm. Within the last week, we've seen reports of some discussions between kind of the oil and biofuels sector on whether or not they might be able to kind of sing kumbaya on the same piece of legislation to allow for those year-round sales and get some kind of level of consistency rather than the boutique market of the Midwest was the phrase that the American Petroleum Institute used. I know that the EPA doesn't get in the habit of writing legislation, but a national standard, is that a philosophy that this agency would support?
We're certainly interested in the conversations that are happening on Capitol Hill. I've been getting some updates on how those are going, and it's always good to see the biofuels and the petroleum refining sectors coming together to work on things. I think that's to everyone's benefit. But we certainly are not, we don't have an official role in that right now. We're just observing it.
We'll be right back with more from EPA Agricultural Advisor Rod Snyder right after this.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back. In addition to a renewable fuels portfolio, the Environmental Protection Agency is also working on an update to the Waters of the U.S. rule. EPA Agricultural Advisor Rod Snyder says despite the fact that work is happening in conjunction with work on a Supreme Court case, the ruling of which is expected in 2023, the EPA plans to move forward with its WOTUS work.
Yeah, I think all of the public documentation has signaled that we would have a final rule out before the end of this calendar year on WOTUS. That is still the timeline that we're working on. It's been a really robust process since the proposal came out last December to collect public comment, to review that. We had over 120,000 comments that came into the docket early in 2022 after the proposal was released, a large number from the ag sector. We also held 10 regional roundtables around the country. Many of those were hosted by farm groups, California Farm Bureau, Arizona Farm Bureau, North Carolina Farm Bureau, et cetera, helping to bring a regional lens to how farmers and landowners experience the WOTUS regulation and how we can improve implementation on the ground. I think there's the rulemaking effort, but then there's also a lot of details that are just farmers say, the way that these decisions are made can vary from region to region. So how do we bring some greater consistency working with Army on that? That's some of the feedback that we got during the roundtables. So we've learned a lot this year, I think, just sitting down and talking with folks. I think the final proposal will reflect a lot of that, the final rule, not a proposal, will reflect all of that input. And I would expect to see that sometime probably in December.
I know neither of us can prejudge the text that's going to be in the Supreme Court's ruling in the Sackett case, but is it a possibility that that ruling could cause the EPA to have to go back to the drawing board on this rulemaking that it's currently doing?
Well, we're at the moment mostly focused on getting this final rule out this year that I think, you know, is a critical next step to bring stability. The reason why we needed to move forward is there's just been so much ping-ponging back and forth and inconsistency over the years that farmers and landowners need certainty, and we need durability in this regulation. And so we didn't want to lose any time. So this proposal, this final rule, I think will begin to set sort of a baseline. If the Supreme Court comes out with something next year that we need to adapt to or modify, we'll cross that bridge at that time. But right now our entire focus is on getting this final rule out and doing the job that Congress has told us to do. You know, it is EPA's responsibility to set these regs and set the definitions, and we're doing that.
Mm-hmm. In the last week, a large number of farm groups, I believe the number is over 320, sent a letter to congressional leaders expressing some concern about sort of new interpretations of the federal pesticide law, FIFRA, and wondering what state regulations might have to play in that. I guess, you know, what do you think should be, what is your message on the part of the agency to farmers concerned about the availability of inputs due to, you know, atrazine, dicamba, due to some of these federal and state regulatory issues that we're seeing?
Well, Administrator Regan has said on many occasions that our job is to follow the science and follow the law. And as you know, EPA has the primary responsibility for creating the labels and setting the standards for pesticide usage, and we will continue to do that. There have been a lot of challenges over the years, not just around FIFRA, but also the Endangered Species Act that I think has, you know, created some complexity for us. We are, just yesterday, we released a new endangered species work plan, updated work plan, that will help to make sure that when we make registrations and when we put out labels, that they're also defensible under the ESA. We think that having stronger ESA protections and provisions within the labels will ensure that these products can remain available to farmers into the future. Right now, there's a lot of uncertainty because we haven't been able to consistently, over decades, it's not just this administration or Democrat or Republican, for decades, we haven't been able to bring the ESA consultations along with the pesticide registration process. So that's something that we're actively working on right now to fix going forward.
Rod, I also understand that there has been a new advisory team named for agriculture and rural issues at the EPA. What can you tell me about that team?
We're very excited. Yesterday, Administrator Regan announced new members of the Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee. This is a body that helps to advise the administrator on agriculture and rural policy. It's been around for about 15 years now. It's one of the best ways in which the ag sector has a seat directly at the table and providing policy input to the agency. And so we have now 37 members of this committee as of yesterday. We'll have our first kickoff meeting early next year. The focus for the next 24 months will be on the intersection of agriculture and climate change and how EPA can help support farmers and ranchers to through voluntary incentive-based initiatives, through public-private partnerships to reduce emissions, sequester carbon, and also just have a more resilient food system in the face of extreme weather. So we want to be partners to the ag sector, and the members of the committee that we appointed yesterday are going to be a big part of that conversation.
Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back with our final guest on AgriPulse Newsmakers this week, Chris Bliley with Growth Energy, right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back. The extra time afforded to the Environmental Protection Agency to finalize RVOs by the end of November was in line with a consent decree reached with Biofuel Trade Association, Growth Energy. Chris Bliley with Growth Energy says in talks with the agency, regulators said they needed more time to finalize the upcoming set rule.
EPA just felt like they really needed more time to hammer out some of the last pieces of the set rule. And this really is their first foray under the RFS set. We're frustrated certainly with the delay, the additional couple weeks, but it looks like everything is on pace to get done by the end of the month. And more importantly, the end deadline for getting a final rule out in June did not move, and we are not going to move that deadline. Mm-hmm. And so we're anxious to see what that proposal looks like. And more importantly, we're anxious to get those things finalized. Because this, as I said, this is really the first foray under the set, and will be, from everything we understand, it will be more than 1 year. So really build on the growth that we saw in 2022.
Well, and that was kind of my next question, is based on conversations that you've had with the agency to this point, I know they probably haven't teased you with the exact volumes, but what are you expecting to see in this rule based on those conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally, I think we're hopeful. Again, we haven't heard anything about specific volumes, but we're hopeful that we continue to build on 2022. That we get those 15 billion gallons of conventional biofuel, we get the additional 250 million gallons outstanding from the litigation. We expect to see a multi-year proposal to give everybody a little more certainty and frankly avoid some of the delays that we've seen over the past few years. And beyond that, I think we also are anxious to see some of the analysis that EPA will do in sort of justifying growing volumes going forward. I think the other piece is capturing the growth in advanced biofuels with things like renewable diesel. And so really making sure that it captures those things as well as additional cellulosic volumes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the fact that it's widely expected to be a multi-year proposal, but I have to wonder, is there any danger in that? Because I know you're expecting, and based on comments from the administrator, he seemed to imply that the biofuel sector would be happy with what they saw, but is there any danger in a multi-year proposal if you don't end up liking what you see?
Yeah, I mean, there could be some challenges, and I think that's why we expect to see maybe a 2-year, possibly 3-year, rather than going out too far into a crystal ball that's frankly a bit too foggy. So I think sort of that, closer in mid-range is probably a good thing. It gives more certainty, but yet doesn't go too far out where you're wildly wrong with potential projections.
We'll be right back with more from Bliley right after this.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. Finding a nationwide fix to the E15 dilemma is an issue that has been vexing the biofuels industry for years. Chris Bliley with Growth Energy says a number of options are on the table, and Growth is committed to finding a solution that works.
Well, I think we're anxious to explore all different options. Certainly, we're part of the conversation about a national solution on legislation. We need a national solution so that, everywhere E15 is sold, it can continue to be sold year-round. Certainly, we're very supportive of what the governors have done in those 7 states. And so they're taking it on their own terms to provide sort of a permanent solution. And if that helps address a national, you know, path forward, we're, you know, very optimistic there. I think for us, really, it's pushing it all envelopes to make sure that this gets done so that the retailers we work with, the nearly 3,000 retailers, you know, consumers can continue to see the benefits that we saw this summer. We saw consumer savings up to, you know, $1 a gallon in some locations, average savings of 16 cents. And, you know, nationwide, that's more than $20 billion saved, as well as the greenhouse gas benefit. So, you know, we want to find really any path forward that allows E15 to be sold year round, and that's in place in time for next summer.
You've seen legislation on the E15 making that year round before. Those bills, are the concept of introducing a bill on that is not necessarily new. What could be new here, though, is getting the oil industry to support a piece of legislation. But I guess I'll ask you, is that going to be enough to get a piece of legislation like that over the finish line on a really narrowly divided Capitol Hill?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it's going to take a lot of work, and it's certainly no guarantees. But, you know, we saw the House pass legislation earlier this year to provide year-round sale of E15. There's certainly a strong support in a number of Senate offices as well. So we're optimistic. But again, I don't think we can take the foot off the pedal on any of these different solutions. I think we need to continue to press forward so that come next summer, these retailers have the ability to do that, because we can't leave them without the ability to sell.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit in discussing that legislation about that narrow Capitol Hill majority that we're looking to see in the next Congress. Going to be narrow majorities in both chambers. What does that mean for biofuels policy?
Well, I think for us, we have supporters on both sides, and it's always been key for our industry to have supporters on both the Republican and Democrat side. And so, you know, it's hard to see a ton of legislation moving. I think for us, it's really emphasizing the various benefits of biofuels, be that consumer savings, be that energy security, particularly with the unrest we see in Europe, and be the climate air quality benefits that we've certainly talked about with this administration. I think that's really going to be the key. And we're, you know, the RFS has always enjoyed strong bipartisan support. So we'll continue to you know, work with those champions on Capitol Hill.
Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good to see you, Spencer.
Our thanks to Chris and our other guests for joining us on AgriPulse Newsmakers this week, and we appreciate you watching this week's show in our on-location format. Be sure to check back next week and in the weeks to come for a return to in-studio production, as well as a wide-ranging discussion on a wide array of agricultural issues. I think that's going to do it for this week's AgriPulse Newsmakers. For AgriPulse, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one. Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.